are about to listen to Where Your Treasure Is, the podcast where faith and finance meet. Please note that the views expressed are our own and in no way represent any form of financial advice. And remember, investments can go down as well as up. Happy listening.
Hello and welcome to Where Your Treasure Is, a podcast where we pose questions about faith and finance and often everything in between. I am here with my co-host Simon, who is a chartered financial planner, which sounds very fancy. And Simon, we are here for a bonus episode, and that means we have a guest today. Tell us more.
It is a great excuse, Bex, to chat to other people. I love talking to you, but sometimes let's bring somebody else into the mix for some different conversation. And actually today we have a voice that some of our listeners might have heard before, because Mark Whittington, our guest today, has, I was going to say appeared on the podcast before, but you can't have appeared because it's an audio recording. His voice has certainly been heard, because we got Mark into one of our previous bonus episodes for our Vox Pops. We asked some questions and Mark was kind enough to give us some answers. And we liked his answers so much, we thought we'd get him on for some more of them. So Mark, hello. Welcome to Where Your Treasure Is.
Hello. Hello, Simon. Hello, Bex.
Well, we need to find out who you are, because apart from Bex and I, no one knows who you are. So Mark, start us off. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what do you do?
Okay, well, I'm Mark. I'm approaching what I prefer to call reassignment rather than retirement. I'm a dad. I'm a husband. I became a Christian at 15 in a school assembly. I was born in Nottingham, went to university in Bristol, first job in Chester, second job in Leamington, third job in Leamington, and then moved to Aberdeen for a job 20 years ago, which is where I got to know you, Simon, and you, Bex, too.
And we are very grateful for that. I would love to just delve a little bit further into how you became a Christian. You said it was at a school assembly. What did that look like? What was it that made you think, yes, there's something in this that I want to follow and give my life to?
Well, I was 15, which is quite a long time ago now, and I had no real Christian background, but I ended up in this assembly, and this sixth former, as they were called in England, was talking about how he'd been a football hooligan, a fairly common activity in Nottingham back then, and how he'd found that less satisfying than he thought it would be. And he'd found Jesus instead, and he explained how we could find Jesus as well. And I was sitting on the floor in the gym, and I felt this overwhelming presence and knew that I had changed. And that was the beginning, really, 48 years ago. And I've just had my 12th birthday as a Christian, as it was February the 29th back then.
Mark, you said something like, it's the 12th anniversary of me becoming a Christian.
Yeah.
But it can't be the 12th.
It can.
It's the 12th.
Yes. 29th of February. Think about it.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
The boy's a genius.
Oh, too smart for me.
And amazingly, even more amazingly perhaps, my friend Stephen, who was sitting next to me on the gym floor, had exactly the same experience. We didn't chat till 2 weeks later, and last time I chatted to him, he's down in London at church doing stuff, playing the drums. And yeah, that all started on February 29th, 1976.
1976. Mark, that means you've been a Christian longer than I've been alive. That's impressive. I'm now thinking, well, this is a spirit-filled man. The Lord spoke to Mark, called him into service, and he has been preaching and teaching for the last 48 years, and he is a world-famous theologian. Is this right? Is this who you are, Mark?
Little short there, I think, Simon. I've moved in a generally positive direction most of the time, I'd hope, think. Have I achieved the things that God has for me to do? I think he's still got more things for me to do, I think would be my positive angle on that. We can all look back and think, was that the right thing to do? Wasn't it? And probably we've all got a bit of a mixed response there, haven't we? God is in everything that we do, and we're trying to live our lives for him. And that is not easy, and it's not obvious.
So if you're not a full-time theologian, unfortunately, this is a faith and finance podcast. Mark, what is it that you have done with most of the last 48 years of your life?
Ah, well, finance has been more to the fore in terms of my job titles than theology. So I'm an accountant, trained as an accountant, then had what now looks like a kind of transitional role, being finance trainer for a large industrial company for 6 years, helping the managers to understand the financial systems and analyze customers and so on. And then 30 years ago, I switched and became an academic. first at the University of Warwick, and for the last 20 years at the University of Aberdeen.
And so how does being an academic inform your thinking? How are you approaching financial issues from that point of view?
I think being an academic has changed the way that I see things and how I think. Firstly, I don't think there is any question that shouldn't be asked. There may, however, be constructive and less constructive ways of asking a particular question. Often we would like to put certain questions off the table. We see politicians do that all the time, of any persuasion. And yet, the job of the academic is to ask those difficult questions, preferably politely. Secondly, we look around and we like to define and control questions and problems. And the world isn't really like that. Experts are generally people who manage to come up with boundaries with a narrow scope so they can be an expert. I might be an expert on defined benefit pensions.
Oh, well, you could have a job with me then, Mark. Come and join the business.
I might be an expert on that. However, as soon as you start to broaden those boundaries, whether you're an expert or not starts to change. The world doesn't have strict boundaries. There's nothing that says we can talk about money and not talk about anything else. And when we're talking about anything else, we're probably talking about money a bit as well.
So one of the things you've picked up on there, Mark, is framing of questions and asking of questions. Are you going to feel uncomfortable today if we're asking you the questions?
Ooh.
Do you prefer to be the question master?
Academics, maybe me in particular, are rather better at questions than answers. And I think in some ways that's okay. My job, I think, is to help people to think and to question and then be equipped to face future situations and have a way of working out answers. So, sad example, I might be teaching international accounting standards. And in a way, they're facts. They're on PDFs that are hundreds of pages long. But what they say is how the accounting profession sees the right way to do accounts today. It's not the same as it was yesterday. And it will not be the same as it will be tomorrow. Maybe that's about change in the way things happen, or maybe it's about changing opinions. So sometimes my students want answers, and sometimes they get frustrated because I try not to give direct answers. Like, this is a way of doing it, it's not necessarily the way of doing it. Jesus used parables to teach, and even his closest followers had to think hard to understand what he meant sometimes. Others found him challenging and would have preferred he wasn't saying or doing things the way he was. And I find some solace in that sometimes.
Asking questions is great, but what do we do if we don't actually have the financial knowledge or skill to answer them?
I think there's a number of angles to the answer, one of which is to listen to good podcasts, like Where Your Treasure Is, and to read good newspapers, a variety of background of newspapers. People that you learn to trust, people speaking from different angles as well. One thing I've been challenged by recently is that most of the theologians I've been reading are white and they're male. They come from a similar context as me. And whilst I'm living in my context for sure, probably I'm going to get some insights from reading people from different cultures and women as well. And I need to try and make sure I do that. And when we're trying to learn about money, we need to make sure that we're not just listening to people who are saying the things that we want to hear or the things that fit with our background. And with social media, that is all too easy, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we've got to be careful that we don't fall into that trap and challenge ourselves by, I'll listen to someone I don't always agree with and see what they've got to say.
You were talking about the culture in which we live, the experience we have, and for us, maybe it's a white Western culture. And yet when we read the Bible, and if we try and interpret the Bible, and we can even narrow it down to finance within the Bible, the culture that Jesus was speaking in and to is very different than the one that we live in. And yet we've managed over our lifetime and the lifetime of many before us to somehow interpret what Jesus says, and it feels okay to Christians to hear him saying certain things. I'm just wondering, Mark, in your experience, is there a similar issue we have that we're still culturally narrow? We've taken Jesus' words in the first century and converted it into a white Western understanding. Are there other understandings of faith and finance we should be thinking about getting perspective on, maybe?
I'm sure. And I think it's worth saying that people in other cultures have probably done exactly the same thing in their way, too. Jesus was very challenging to the society around him back in the first century, and I suspect our culture, let's say British culture today, or indeed pretty much at any point in the past as well, has not really been that close to the vision of society, the vision of kingdom that Jesus had. We can all too easily seek to fit Jesus into our culture rather than fitting our culture into Jesus. And so it's not surprising if we struggle to think, what does this mean for us today? What does being a genuine, authentic Christian look like today in terms of how I manage my money, how I manage my life? What are the principles behind that, and how do those principles work out today? One of those principles will be generosity. What does generosity look like today? Generosity at one point in Acts chapter 2 looked like sharing everything. Generosity at another point looked like giving, and giving to a point perhaps where it hurt to help people with a famine in Jerusalem or whatever it happened to be.
It's so fascinating, isn't it, how we can interpret things differently and how one word can have several different meanings and connotations depending on our culture. And just as you were speaking, Mark, I was reminded of a book that I read that I'm just going to throw out as a recommendation in case people want to read further. It was Misreading Scripture with Western Eyes, Removing Cultural Blinders to Better Understand the Bible by E. Randolph Richards and Brandon J. O'Brien. And it was really exploring what was the culture the Bible is set in, what did that mean to people at the time, and how do we translate that to today? So for instance, one of the things that springs to mind is that in the story of the prodigal son, the fact that it was set in the time of famine was really crucial to people hearing that in the first century. But as Western readers, we would often just skip over that, and it unpacks some of the importance behind that. So that's a little tangent that you can feel free to dive deeper on and explore and get back to us with your thoughts.
Bex.
Yes.
I'd just like to say that I'm with you on that book.
Well, I feel like it's an even better recommendation now it's been backed up by an actual academic. But you were also talking about money and culture, and it feels like sometimes money can almost have a culture of its own or take on a life of its own within our own culture. And I know you've spoken a little bit before about the term financialization. Can you talk to us a bit about that and what that looks like in terms of money and culture and how they mesh together or not?
Sure. Financialization is a messy kind of word, isn't it? It's the kind of word that somebody who's really into their language might think, I wish that word didn't exist.
No comment.
Culture changes, but the Bible doesn't. And how we're called to live in particular and changing circumstances may differ. Jesus made it clear that we can't serve both God and money. And a continuing question for me is, does our culture provide a slippery slope for the Christian in living a money-orientated life, perhaps without being aware of it? And that's where this word financialization comes in, because over the last 50 years, I think we could say that our culture has become even more financial. It has financialized, if you like. Now, in some dictionaries, you'll find the word financialization just meaning that the financial sector has become a more core component of the economy, has become central, and it's also seen to be wealth generating in a way that it wasn't before. Indeed, if you think back to 1968, and I'm aware that neither you, Bex, or Simon can think back to 1968, but anyway, let's pretend, an incredible thing happened in 1968. And that was the powers that be decided that gross domestic product, the way of measuring the size of an economy, should include the financial sector, because before then it didn't. And before then it was thought the financial sector did not add value. It just did the transactions for the things that mattered, and it was a kind of background thing. And since then, of course, it's become part of GDP, and it has grown, and finances seem to be a big and impressive thing. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm saying society used to view it differently. Financialization, then, I would suggest, is also about the fact that we measure things with money, and we do that increasingly, and that's inevitable. The problem is when we only use the dimension of money to measure things. An example, perhaps even more true in England than Scotland, would be that there is an emphasis on universities running courses that lead to well-paid job outcomes and pressure to pull courses that don't have good and clear job outcomes. Clearly, it's important that getting a job after university is part of the reason for going. However, trying to say the only thing that matters is getting a well-paid job after university denies some of the other reasons that people might be choosing and seems to make them inappropriate or wrong. And that, to me, sums up what financialization might be. You know, the only way of making a good decision is by making it a financial decision.
Your example there, Mark, of perhaps overusing money as a measurement, potentially a measurement of success, shall we say. It reminds me of a mistake that King David made back in the day. Now, you'll find it in 1 Chronicles 21, first couple of verses, and King David is trying to work out if he's being successful. He wants to get an inventory of the size of his army. And it turns out that God wasn't very happy with him for judging his success on the size of his army, as opposed to trusting in what God had helped him achieve and his relationship with God. And so when you talk about the danger we face of measuring our success in terms of money, it kind of parallels. We can totally miss the mark of what God defines success in our life to be. And I wondered, Mark, if you would share maybe some thoughts from your own life. Have you ever made that mistake of maybe judging where you are in life based on financial success? Or have you learned other lessons of actually, there are other aspects of life that matter so much more to me than just money? What might those things be to you, Mark?
I am sure I have thought about money too much. It'd be very hard to be an accountant and for that not to be true, I think. So, two thoughts. Firstly, when I was still working in finance training, I was aware that that job was taking me away from home more and more. And I was sitting watching a film. It was Hook, you might recall, the follow-up to Peter Pan. Good film. And at one point, the busy dad who's not been looking after his kids, who was the Peter Pan, of course, back in the day, gets out his checkbook and tries to change the situation with his checkbook. And what really needed to happen is Peter Pan, Robin Williams, of course, needed to be spending time with his kids. And I looked at that and thought, I need to change my job. Mm. That really struck me. It just shows that God can use anything, really. So that was a trigger point for me moving to being an academic. A different work-life balance, a different income balance, for sure. So that was one thing. The other thing that springs to mind is over my 30 years as an accounting academic, I have had the opportunity to move what I look at from being very financial numbers based to being part of a movement, I suppose, that says accounting isn't just about numbers, financial numbers, that is. It's about measuring. And we use phrases like accountability because holding to account is the root of accounting. And that can mean social. It can mean environmental issues. And measuring that and holding people to account for their actions as they impact society, as they impact the environment, should be seen alongside, I would argue, financial numbers. And different people are more or less interested in different measurements. And accounting historically, and even today, is so dominated by telling shareholders, the owners, what's going on. And yet there are other people who have very legitimate reasons for knowing what's going on and for companies, organizations to be accountable to them too. And that's been underplayed.
I really like the way you broadened out the definition of success there and also just your openness to hearing God in all situations, including when you're watching a children's film. I love that. And as you were talking, it reminded me of some of the challenges of running your own business. So I know that sometimes it can be really easy for me to use how much money I'm making as a metric of success because you don't have the same feedback, you don't have a manager, there's no promotion coming. And actually, it's been really important for me to broaden that out into actually how satisfied am I with my job? How many people have I helped? Or even when I'm thinking about pricing structures, actually, if I'm going to potentially charge more, that's not just to put more money in my bank, but it also frees up time that I could then use for whatever God's asking me to do as well and work less and use some of that time in another way.
You spoke, Mark, about being better at asking questions rather than necessarily having all the answers. When you think about faith and finance, what kind of questions are the ones that have stuck with you over your life? Questions that you keep coming back to where maybe there isn't an obvious answer. What topics do you like to ask people about or do you wrestle with?
I think I wrestle with quite a lot, really. I come back to questions quite often. Very rarely will I think I have resolved that for all time. I might have resolved something for a particular situation, a particular period of time, but how much to save, for example, would be a good question. And at different periods of life, that will be different. At some points, it might be impossible to save. Other times, it might be tempting to spend, but actually saving would be the right thing. How much do I give versus how much do I save? Am I spending too much? All these are questions that look different at different times of life, I think. Am I putting God first? I think that's a question pretty much every day, because it's all too easy to say words and not mean them. Perhaps not to even realize we're not meaning them, but to live a way that doesn't fit with what we just said. And maybe that would only be clear to us ourselves and not even to those around us. I'll give you an example. The Lord's Prayer has as its first request, "Your kingdom come on earth as in heaven." Some of the most familiar words in Scripture, I'm sure. And a couple of weeks ago, a politician joined a new party, and his first statement at the news conference was, "I want my country back." I've got no idea what the guy was actually thinking, but nevertheless, to me, that's coming across as your equivalent first prayer, first request. "I want my country back," as opposed to Jesus saying, we should be praying, "Your kingdom come on earth as in heaven." So the question to myself then is, what's my real first prayer? And am I living it out? Do I want God's country, the kingdom, as the Lord's Prayer puts it, to come? Or am I just bumbling along with the rest of culture and society around me, thinking I'm doing okay, but actually God is looking and thinking, if only he'd wake up and realize how inappropriate some of that behavior is.
Wow, that is deeply challenging. I feel like I need to go and sit and think about that for at least half an hour.
I probably need to go and lie down, I think. But anyway, yeah.
And I also found it wonderfully reassuring that you said that actually you're not answering questions for all time, but for a particular moment in time.
One of the things that is lovely when we get guests on is that we're getting different perspective. Mark, from where you are, having been an academic, having been in university, having studied and taught all things accounting, are there any key principles that you've learned over that time? I wish I'd learned that 30 years ago. Can I pass that on? What have you learned you could pass on to us and the rest of the Where Your Treasure Is audience?
I spent many years being a fairly normal accountant, if you like, seeing things as either having a pound sign in front of them or as not being relevant. And it took me a long time to wake up from that, and a number of experiences meeting a number of people to realize there was a different way to being an accountant, not to deny what it had been, but to broaden it out. And I think the profession has a long way still to go on that, and I hope it will go in that direction. So, for example, if you take the professional exams that accountants do, at the moment, there are mentions of other things, non-financial reporting being a phrase, environmental and social. But the balance is still, let's be generous and say it's 5%, 95%. However, if the environment really matters, wouldn't you be putting that at 30, 33%? If society really matters, wouldn't you be putting that at 33%, perhaps? So where's the balance? I wish I'd been saying that earlier, but I wasn't. I suppose I'm saying it now. So let's celebrate me saying it now.
Absolutely.
And it's absolutely something I am now experiencing in my professional life, decisions people have around how to invest money. And sometimes there is very clearly a playoff, I suppose, between financial return and non-financial return. You can invest, you can live, you can make buying decisions in a way that are better for the environment, better for society, better for culture, better for your family, but are worse for your bank balance. And people find it very hard to work out how important those things are for them compared to a monetary benefit or disadvantage. And as a society, I think it's one we will grapple with for a long time to come. But the answer isn't to die with the most money in the bank.
I can come back on that. I'll say something and I'll ask you a question, Simon. First of all, you will recall, our listeners also might recall, that Jesus has a story about a man who dies with three new barns full of grain. And what's the value of that at your death is effectively what Jesus says. And the answer is nothing. We can talk about the talents and whatever in another parable. And clearly there are things that we do that add value. But dying with money isn't one of them. We can quite legitimately think about wanting to sort our kids out a bit and whatever. That's fine. But just dying with money in the bank doesn't do anything for anybody, least of all you, as you pass on. So, Simon, the question for you is, you're a financial planner, a financial advisor. How big is the capital F on the front of financial there? You've just said that people come to you and they're trying to balance off different things in their lives, which are sometimes more money versus a bit less money, but a bit more of something else that would be good. How do you, qualified as a chartered financial planner, see yourself helping them through that conundrum?
Thank you for the challenge, Mark. I shall see if I can rise to it. So a phrase that my professional peers have started to use much more often is something called lifestyle financial planning. Now, I think it's an improvement on just financial planning, where finance is the focus. If we make it lifestyle financial planning, then clients begin to understand that we care much more about the lives they are living than just the money in the bank. And a phrase that I have used before, and I will use many times again, is that money is a tool. It is to be used. It is to be utilized. It is not to be aspired to in and of its own sense. So when I'm talking with prospective clients and existing clients, the question often is, what is it that you're trying to achieve? If I'm being quite specific, I might ask them questions like, what is success to you? And hopefully it's not a big bank balance. Who matters to you? What are the things you would like to achieve in life? What if you knew you only had a year left to live? What would you do with the time given to you? And if you can keep probing, and the question basically is, why? Why is that important to you? Why does that matter? Why is that your measure of success? If you can get fundamentally down to their why, you almost work out what their purpose of being is, which often they haven't really worked out themselves, but you help them get there. And once you find that out, you can then say, brilliant, let us use your money, your wealth, your possessions, your earning capacity, your influence, your knowledge, your experience, your wisdom to help you achieve your why, your purpose. And just occasionally, you come across that person whose answer goes beyond themselves. Yes, it goes to their children and their spouse and their family. But when their why becomes more holistic, when it's more than just personal self-actualization, to use an academic phrase perhaps, it's about, can we change society? Can we change culture? For Christians I speak to, can we change this world for the kingdom? Money is the tool which so often fuels change. So I would much prefer to be somebody who has stewarded wealth wisely, put it to use, and put it to use not as the owner, as the manager of that money. It's not mine. God gave it to me. Why did he give it to me? What is the job he's given me to do? Can I utilize that money successfully in his eyes? And if I die with not a penny in the bank, but I get the well done, good and faithful servant, then absolutely, success, tick. And we all have that conundrum, but we don't always talk that way. We don't always have permission to talk that way. And sometimes to be the voice, the one in the room who isn't just doing financial accounting, the one in the room who isn't just trying to make as much money for their clients as possible, can challenge people. And I think it's a great part of our calling to be the salt and the light wherever God has put us.
And what's fascinating about your comments there, Simon, whether you are advising from a Christian perspective or some of your colleagues who may not be, really the questions you're beginning to explore are questions of formation and spiritual formation. And I love some of John Mark Comer's teaching where he talks about we are all being formed by something or someone, whether we recognize it or not. And so it sounds to me like some of the things you're unpacking with your clients or that are helpful for us all to unpack are questions like, how has my family background shaped my view of money? How has my education shaped that? How has being born in a capitalist society formed my opinions and perspective about what matters? And actually, only as we begin to unpick what has formed us up until this point, whether good, bad, or indifferent, can we then begin to get to that why and becoming more like Jesus and doing what he did?
That was very interesting, Bex. How an academic might term that is recognizing your assumptions, what we sometimes call priors, things that are beyond question. And it's very important sometimes to take them and not put them beyond being questioned. If you look at Jesus in the Gospels, he spent a lot of time asking difficult questions that people would probably have preferred him not to ask. The Good Samaritan parable is designed to ask the question, who is my neighbor? And to answer it. And to answer it by completely turning on the head how people wanted that answer to be. They wanted the answer to be people like me, people living close to me, and definitely not the people over this border over there who live a bit differently, have a little bit of a different history. I don't want them to be my neighbor. And Jesus tells this story where that person from that other area just over the border actually acted in a way which was clearly neighborly to someone like them. One other thought, and this applies more broadly, I suppose, as well. You may know the story from Luke chapter 4, where Jesus has just been baptized by John the Baptist and he's gone out into the desert and he's tested by the devil. And the devil offers him a range of things if he'll accept bowing down to the devil. And these things are good things, like you can rule everything as long as you bow down to me. And you think, gosh, if I'd been Jesus and I kind of knew what was coming, which was pretty awful, like the cross and whatever, quite how much detail or not, I'm not sure. But nevertheless, things were going to be tough. And somebody said, you can have a lot of what you want as long as you take this shortcut. Would I be tempted? And I suppose the answer would be yes. And somehow we have to learn from that and know that the end doesn't justify the means. Living with integrity means we have to try and look at how we're living, even if it's tempting sometimes to think, if I did that, that will get me to where I think I want to be a bit faster. I don't think God's interested in speed in that sense. He's interested in integrity on the journey. Faith is a journey. Our financial lives are a journey too. And Jesus is looking for integrity in that. And that's the challenge to me, for sure.
What a fascinating and challenging conversation to get to listen into and be a part of. And the good news is that if you like difficult questions, we have a whole series of them coming. Simon, tell us more about what's coming next season.
Well, Mark was pointing out that sometimes questions are the best way to get to some of the answers that we need. Sometimes just more questions is the way to go. We recognise that people have questions they would love for us to answer. They have questions they would love financial advisors and theologians in general to answer. So we're going to take a selection of questions from the world, from the interweb we have gone, and we're going to ask ourselves these questions and try and bring you the Where Your Treasure Is answers. Where faith and finance meet, can we help you navigate some of the choices that we have to make as Christians living in a modern financialized society? So Mark, you have set the scene for us very nicely. We hope that you will be listening in to our next season when it is produced.
Absolutely.
And feel free to email in with some difficult questions of your own if you think we're not going hard enough. Bex, why not remind us, how can people get in touch if they've got questions for our next season?
You can get in touch with us at whereyourtreasureis@freerangepodcasting.co.uk. Alternatively, you can send us a message on Instagram at whereyourtreasureispodcast. And if there are any particularly tricky questions, either I'll be throwing them at Simon or asking Mark to come back and help us out. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. We have just loved this conversation and you've certainly given me a lot of food for thought.
Mark, thank you so much and hopefully we'll see you again sometime.
It's been a total pleasure. Thank you.
See you next time. Bye.
Bye.
This podcast has been brought to you by Free Range Podcasting. Let us take you where you and your podcast want to go.